This is Snobs on Film.
I like to deal with human relationship and circumstances, time changings, and social obligation versus free will. The wuxia world, the hero's world, has the psychological gray areas which I get attracted to. It's a world of its own. It's a fantasy world of people who knows martial art, not only like a great skill, but was able to elevate their spirit to enlightenment.
In previous martial arts films that I've done, we've always put loyalty, honor, tradition, and martial arts ahead of everything else. But now he deals with emotions like fear, death, which is something that we have touched on, but we have not really truly explored in that way.
It's a very interesting, fascinating, externalized kind of world. When people can fly, anything could happen. Maybe there's a chance you cut through it and drive into the emotional core more easily.
My name is Arthur, and I am joined by Ayiko, Isaac, and Jahan, and this is Snobs on Film. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, released in 2000, May 2000, it debuted at the Cannes Film Festival, released in the U.S. December of 2000, and in several East Asian countries between June and, I want to say, August, but won an Oscar for Best Foreign Film. I remember that specifically because I was screaming at my television when this film lost the Oscar to Gladiator. Mm. And I felt they were absolutely robbed because this is an excellent film. It's one of my favorite films. Mm-hmm. So you can hear me wax poetically and gush over this film. Before we get to it, there will be spoilers in this episode, a lot of them, but let's get to a synopsis of the film.
There will be mispronunciations as well.
There will be several mispronunciations from Isaac, and
which I apologize profusely. My co-hosts are not going to apologize. They're going to
mispronunciate. We're all going to apologize. None of us are Mandarin Chinese speakers, but we are going to do our very best to respect the names of both the characters and the actors which they are portrayed. And although the 2000 film classic Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is full of martial artistry and bold visuals, it is the subtlety of unspoken passions and suppressed desire that creates its greatest impact. Michelle Yeoh and Zhang Ji portray parallel characters whose internal struggle pits what they have outwardly accepted against what they inwardly long for. Chow Yun-fat plays Master Li, a famous warrior whose equally famous sword goes missing. Soon, the story of all three characters begins to orbit around this Green Destiny sword, and the question becomes, can any of them forgive and redeem themselves before it's too late? There are a few stories of redemption, few character redemptive arcs, in this film, some more subtle than others. And even in its title, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, does refer to, in some ways, a power hiding in plain sight. Many of these characters are overlooked, their true power, and that drives the film forward.
Is that just very quickly, is that overlooking and that kind of underrepresentation, is that specifically about the female characters and the fact that, I mean, because I read somewhere that phrase, that idiom, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, refers to masters who aren't as necessarily in the open or as respected. And I read that kind of has something to do with the fact that this is a female-led movie for the most part. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I mean, the female characters it's interesting. I mean, it takes place in, this is 18th century China? Or no, earlier than that.
I think the time period is meant to be vague. I think it's obviously during a certain era, but it's a huge era of time. And I think that Ang Lee was purposefully, you know, not wanting to be so historically specific, mm-hmm. and kind of just wanted to create his own, you know, his own tableau, essentially.
You know, I would say that this is Ang Lee's masterpiece. Visually, it's just absolutely gorgeous. The sound, the score by Tan Dung is equally marvelous. I am going to need some balance in this show because, I mean, it's like everything's great. It's like the credit sequence. Oh, my God, you know. But let me kind of kick it off by talking about a quality that, Isaac, you just raised, and something that I really, really enjoyed about this film is that it's driven by its female characters. And for me, the centerpiece of the film is the character Xu Lin, played by Michelle Yeoh. And I feel that it in a lot of ways, it's her movie.
Mm-hmm.
She is a master swordsman, very dangerous. And she is also the longtime friend of swordsman, sword master Li Mu Bai, played by Chow Yun Fat. And there has been an unspoken love between those two characters. They themselves hold them, you know, they suppress their feelings based on the fact that Xu Lin was betrothed to Mu Bai's best friend, who died some years past. And
Manco.
Yeah. and the two,
Didn't we have this discussion on episode SOF TMS, one of those shows? Jay, didn't we have this? The same discussion,
yes,
like this. Yeah, this scenario, this hypothetical. Hilarious. Devoted listeners are like nodding their head right now because they're like, I remember that when they had that argument.
I remember when
Jay was like, no, it's okay.
I remember when Isaac said, you have to ruin your life because of a book I read.
Uh-huh.
Listen, listeners, yeah, the moral of the story is that if Jay was in charge, this movie would have never happened because he would have got with Michelle Yeoh immediately after I died.
I mean, not immediately, bro.
Couple weeks.
Month. For real, though. I mean, I feel like it's her film. I feel like it's Xu Lin's film because she's the one that is managing a lot of these characters. And I believe she comes into direct contact with almost certainly every major character, but minor character as well. It's like she's the hub where all of this runs through.
Yeah.
And the crux of this is that Li Mu Bai is going to retire. He wants to put down his sword, the Green Destiny Sword. I'm trying to remember how it's described, because it's actually, there is a scene where the sword itself is described and how it was made and the inscriptions that's on the sword. But it's an old sword, mm-hmm. right? And
yeah,
Mu Bai putting this down.
It's between, what's his name? The guy he Governor, gives it to, T. Governor Yu and the other guy, Mube's friend, who he gives the sword to. They have a conversation and they just start just talking about how the sword was formed.
Oh, right.
And what
I'm so sorry. Yep. Yeah. Sir T and Governor Yu.
Right.
Because Mu Bai wants to retire and put down this sword, he tells this to Xu Lin and gives her the sword to give to Sir T. As Xu Lin arrives in Peking, there is a new governor, Governor Yu, and Governor Yu's daughter, Jin Yu, played by Zhang Ji. And they never specifically talk about her age, but I've always thought that she was, 14 years old on the low end, no more than 16 years.
She's older than that,
yeah.
Isn't she?
The actress is, but...
I feel bad about watching it now.
Exactly. Like, wait a minute.
Well, you know,
yeah, she's older than that, bro. Because the desert flashback.
The reason that I say that is because if we're talking about 18th, 19th century anywhere, but 18th, 19th century China, young women were engaged
married
to
off,
be married,
yeah,
like
young,
literally
yeah,
that young.
Right. Yeah, but I'm just saying she.
I mean, dude, she has like a nanny, basically. You know what I'm saying?
For purposes of this show, can we make her late teens, early
20s? Yeah.
Please. Thank you. At least.
Wait, but in the math, when we get to Jade Fox feeling betrayed, she had trained her for, what was it?
10 years.
10 years. Yeah. And then how long had she been hiding what she could actually do from her?
And she was 8 when she started training, so she was at least 18 after those 10 years.
Okay. Okay.
And then she had the desert. She was gone in the desert for a long time.
Yeah. All right, okay. All right. Everybody's
early
feeling better
to
now, right?
Mid-20s.
Okay. All right. So we can talk comfortably then. This is she's basically an adult. Okay.
All right. Let's go.
as Aiko has talked about, has brought up Jade Fox. Jade Fox is the nanny that I was referring to. Jade Fox is the one who looks after Jen and has trained her to be a martial artist as well. And Jade Fox's backstory is that she stole lessons from Wudang Mountain, which is the school and the temple in where Mubai was trained, the secret manual, where Mubai was trained, and Jade Fox was a mistress to Mubai's master, and she subsequently, based on her treatment, poisoned that master and stole pages from the secret manual, Wudang manual. All right, so we have Jade Fox, who is a wanted woman in hiding under the protection of a governor and has trained the governor's daughter.
Is it right to say
is cold blooded, huh?
Is it right to say she's under the protection of the governor? He doesn't know, right? Only the daughter knows. So she's
only the daughter knows, but
she's not under the protection of,
you know what?
But like the way you said it is like she's on the run and she's under the protection of the governor. I don't think he knows.
Okay, that's fair. He doesn't know, but I believe it was Xu Lin that referred to her hiding.
She's 100% hiding, but I think only Xu Lin knows.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
but the thing is, the whole thing about the protection, though, the whole thing about the protection was that if you're going to roll up on a governor, you got to have solid proof. Otherwise, you're not getting in the house, thereby protection. The only other part is just that the daughter, she has excelled greater than Jade Fox,
mm-hmm. right?
In her
she understood the manual better than Jade Fox did. She could read it better than she knew what the symbols meant. She knew all these things.
Jade Fox was illiterate. She could only look at the pictures, basically.
Listeners, never share your secret manual with your disciple. All right, you keep it, you read it, you don't share it with you don't let them read it. You tell them what it says. To this day, Arthur has not told me many, many things. When I need to know how to do certain things, I have to call Arthur and ask him. He won't show me the manual. He'll just explain it. But regardless, the point is that, yeah, she excelled and she kept it hidden from the Jade Fox. She didn't tell her.
Like her power, right.
Yeah, about her abilities. And Jade Fox didn't know until that night that they fought Chow Yun-Fat.
So everybody's in Peking. Except Mubai at this point. Xu Lin gives the destiny sword to Sir T. Jen sees the sword there. She sees this happen. She's definitely read about Mubai. She knows what's up with the Green Destiny. And she wants the lifestyle of a warrior. She wants to be free of people telling her what to do. She wants her own destiny. She wants to just roam the land and kick ass. Just beat people up.
Mm-hmm.
But Jen wants to get up out of there, Jen steals the sword.
But that's like the second, because there's, like you said, there's multiple redemptive arcs happening. I'll get to that because I have kind of like a different thought on that. I'm not sure if it's a redemptive arcs, character arcs. I think it may be redemption one redemption that happens and is reflected in multiple characters. Mm. But the first thing we see, though, I believe, is with the conversation with Chow Yun-fat's character and Michelle Yeoh, and you kind of see there's something between them, and then the conversation between the other guy and is it Michelle Yeoh, and he's like, you know, you guys have never admitted your feelings for each other, blah blah blah. So immediately from the beginning of the film, you understand there is a suppressed love, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. between these two characters, mm-hmm. and that would have been interesting in and of itself. But then I think what happens is as the film progresses, then you get the redemption. Are these characters going to redeem themselves, you know, forgive themselves, redeem themselves, and claim their own path? And I think that's the thing that gets reflected, like you just said, with Jin, because mm-hmm. her struggle is, I'm on a path that I don't want. You know, my aristocratic family has set me on this certain path. We don't know it at the beginning of the film, but she has a love, you know, out in the desert, my man, Lo. Mm-hmm. She has
Dark
a love.
Cloud.
And she wants that. That's her desire. But not only does she want that, she also wants freedom as a woman to not have to follow these patriarchal, you know, the structure that's been laid out for her. She doesn't want that.
Like the arranged
She wants
marriage.
The freedom to do what she wants to do. So I think that there's at the very, it was interesting to me watching this. I hadn't watched this in a long time. And I think, Arthur, I want to ask you, I feel like I saw this movie with you. Did I see this? Do you remember the first time you saw this movie? I know I saw it in the theater when it came out, and I feel like I saw it with you. Maybe it was with the kids. I can't remember, but I remember, I have a vague memory of that when I was watching it.
It is
again.
Very possible we did. Like, I've seen this in the theater like 4 times.
Okay, because I remember going, and so that had been 2000. So I think I saw it with you, and I may have taken a Paris. But I think, you know, watching it again the other night, I was struck by how quickly these themes are introduced early on in the film. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, okay, these paths are laid out, and then from then on, they only deepen. You know, we only get more and more and more of it. And it kind of like, oh, it's like, yeah, I saw where she was going, but now you added this layer. You give me the whole, I mean, there's a mini movie in the middle of this film, you know, the whole,
yeah, the whole desert
uh-huh. thing is like its own thing. But I think that, yeah, there's these multiple arcs kind of laid out, but they all kind of revolve around this idea of almost forgiveness of yourself, mm-hmm. and then redeeming yourself enough to have the courage to go, you know, to follow your own path.
I thought that once Mu Bai found out that Jade Fox was discovered by Xu Lin, that activated him because he wanted to avenge his master's death.
Right.
And that part of his reason for retiring is that he had this he was guilt-ridden because he could not protect his master, or at least be able to find and kill his master's assassin. So I thought that he was kind of on his own thing to be able to, that once he was able to redeem his master's death, assassination, that he would then find peace.
Mm.
Yeah, but he was, I mean, and I'll let Aiko and Jay jump in, but he was, yeah, I think he was deluding himself at that point. And I think later he realizes that, because he says at the end of the film, I wasted my life, you know. And so that to me was a standard. I mean, we all watched the Kung Fu films growing up, and that's, you know, early in the film when the first fight you see, and, you know, they're doing the standard kind of like the stuff that was back in the 70s and 80s with the flying through the air and, you know, that form of Kung Fu. And right. not real life Kung Fu, but, you know, movie and television Kung Fu. That's kind of like presented to you is that at that point, you're like, oh, that's what this movie is about. And then you realize, no, that's not what this movie is about at all. And I think mm-hmm. for Mu Bai's character, that idea of revenge, that's a very standard trope in, you know, any action movie, but definitely in the Kung Fu movies, is like, you kill my master, I'm going to kill, you know, now I got to kill you. That's like,
right.
That's every Kung
right.
Fu movie ever. But. Right. I think that was presented to us almost as a red herring to say that's, you know, that's what you think this is about. That's not what this is about. And by the end of the film, you realize he realized that wasn't what I was really pursuing. That wasn't what I was supposed to pursue. You know, that wasn't going to bring me peace.
So let me ask you this, because I stand by it. I think that drives him, at least in the first third of the film. But then once he meets Jin, he finds a different calling, which is to be her master, someone that he himself can train up as an apprentice.
Exactly.
That he wants that then it's almost as if maybe the best way for me to avenge my master is to assume the role of a master and train one who is deserving of the sword. Because he tells Jen, like, you know, you got the stuff, but you don't know how to use that. And their first actual fight is him, you know, whipping her upside the head with a stick, with a tree branch. He's like, he's got like a twig, and he's just schooling her, and she's got this sword to drive the point that whatever you think you know, you have to. There's a line in it where he talks about that she has to unlearn everything that she feels that she has learned in order to actually
master
what's in her head.
But see, that line, I think. And again, I'm gonna shut up and let you guys jump in because I keep saying because
this is still redemption. I still feel that all of this is functioning off of trying to redeem himself.
No, I think he's functioning off of revenge. I think at that point he's functioning off of revenge because he's looking at everything he's looking at it through the lens of avenging my master. And it's like he tells her that line. I'm paraphrasing too. He says something like, "You have to let go of yourself and then find yourself again." But he should be, it's one of those things, Arthur, we just talked about on Mad Unreal. It's like you're talking to yourself almost. You know, you're telling somebody else something, but you're really talking to yourself. He has to let go of this whole idea of revenge and the Wudan and all this stuff. Let go of all that. Your life, your destiny is right in front of you. And Michelle Yeoh's character, that's what you should be doing. You know, let yourself go, find yourself again. And I think he's kind of deluding himself with this whole quest to, you know, I need a disciple and I'm going to teach you. No, go get Michelle Yeoh, go live off in the country somewhere or whatever, be happy. I think he realizes at the end, he says, I wasted my life.
I'm kind of where Arthur is with it. I feel like while he wasted his life, I always felt like that more meant that he wasted his life having this honor towards his friend when he knew this whole entire time that he was in love with Xu Lin. But in terms of wasting his life, in terms of being a master and seeking revenge, like that's what he did. Like that's what he was supposed to do is, you know, be this, you know, master or master swordsman. But yeah, somebody kills your master at some point. You know, I don't know that he didn't know about where Jade Fox was until he, you know, somebody told him that, or was it Xu Lin that told him where she was? Right. Otherwise, I don't think I thought he came there to tell Xu about the sword, but also to tell her, like, yo, why don't we do this? But he didn't know that Jade Fox was there until she revealed it. And then while he's fighting, what's her name? Jen, that's when he's like, he's asking her, where did you learn this? Like, he sees all of the stuff that he actually knows. And that's when he's like, well, maybe she's worthy of training her, because I thought, like, you know, that was your job, is just to train everybody who, I don't know, is worthy of it or whatever. But I always felt that he was there to kind of reveal what he actually felt, and at the same time hand the sword over. So I don't know, the wasting the life is, I don't know, I don't feel like he was delusional. I feel like as soon as he found out that old girl was there, he's like, well, I can kill two birds with one stone and take her out, and at the same time tell this woman that, you know, I'm in love with her.
So what's the core conflict or the core circumstance that necessitates this redemption, and whom does it revolve? I feel that this film is part love story, part mystery, part revenge tale.
Yeah.
But what's the core situation? That necessitates redemption from any of these characters?
I think it's love.
I think the answer is different depending on each character. So for Xu Lin, I think it's honor and love. I think for Li Mubai, it's honor and love as well. You know, they want to honor the memory of, you know, Xu Lin's departed fiance and Li Mubai's departed friend. If they realize a relationship between them, if they give sort of recognition to this very, very established but non-spoken love between each other, there's this concern that they're somehow being dishonorable to the memory of their departed fiancé and friend, that they're somehow betraying him. That's where the conflict for those two characters lies. That's where the conflict for their relationship lies. I think for Li Mu Bai, his other conflict, and also Xu Lin, her conflict as well, as it regards Zhen, is how far do we go with her? We know that she's in the wrong. We know that she's committed crimes, you know, so far just theft, but, you know, eventually she kind of graduates to accessory to murder, if nothing else, right? How far do we take that? Should she face the same fate as her partner in crime, Jade Fox? Or should we go easier on her? Has she been somehow misled, etc.? You know, Xu Lin, when you know, she goes to her and she tries to sort of reason with her and calls her sister and tries to establish the kind of a bond with her, make a connection with her. Li Mu Bai, he says, look, it's every legend's dream to have a disciple worthy of the lessons. You know, you don't want to sort of forget these things. You want to pass them on as much as possible. They're conflicted in that aspect as well. Zhen Yu is conflicted. Does she follow the honor of her family? Does she follow her personal dreams of freedom, which you guys have talked about? Does she follow her personal dream of love with Lo and forget her family, perhaps bring dishonor to them, or at the very least, never speak to them again? You know, never be welcome back. That's spoken of many, many times in the film. So those are the circumstances that I see for each of the main characters that provide that conflict of, here is the path I'm on, but maybe it's the wrong path. Maybe I need to redeem towards a different direction.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think to add on to that, though, I think that there was a mistake made at some point internally for all of these characters, for the three mains, let's say for Xu Lin, Mu Bai, and for Zhen. Let's just look at them, those three, and call them our leads. There was a mistake inwardly for them. And it was, you know, for all of them, I think it was a understandable mistake, but it's one that they have regretted. So for the grown-ups, you know, for Mu Bai and for Xu Lin, it was, you know, again, the, you know, not admittance of their love for each other because of their, you know, their duty to honor, you know, that they felt that they had for their departed friend. That was, you know, their mistake. We didn't admit our love for each other. We continue to make that mistake by not, you know, admitting that. For Jen, it felt like that non-admittance was, you know, and again, it's completely understandable because of her age, because she was raised by in this culture of, you know, you do what your parents say, you marry off, you know, you continue the family, blah, blah, blah. She, you know, didn't stay in the desert. She didn't, you know, stick to what she wanted. She went on a path, like Jay said, she went on a path that's clearly the wrong one. I don't think there's any question for her. She knows it's the wrong path, you know. And maybe even for Xu Lin and for Mu Bai, they know it's the wrong path. Maybe more so Xu Lin. But I think they're more, as adults, they're more, almost more stubborn. You know, children are a little bit more open to change and for new ideas and freshness, whereas adults, we kind of get stuck in our ways. So as adults, I feel they're a little bit more obstinate about, you know, what they feel is the honorable thing to do. But for, again, I think that all of these, for these three characters, you see the kind of mistakes or the regrets that they have. And that's where the redemption comes in. Can I redeem myself in my own eyes, you know, enough to actually forget all these other things and follow the path that I know is the right path, you know, and is it going to be too late?
Is it going to be too late? That's interesting, because we've covered a few films in this season where we're focusing on redemption arcs, but I'm not sure that any of the films we've covered, any of the sort of redemption arcs we've covered, Safer maybe Beautiful, maybe Safer that, I don't know if they've introduced this kind of time clock on redemption as specifically as Crouching Tiger does.
I think On the Waterfront had an element of it, but not as specifically as this. He runs out of time before he knows there was a clock,
right?
You know, and On the Waterfront.
It's funny to look at a film like this, this kind of magic realist style of filmmaking. It's funny to look at that and say that you can relate to something, but there's so much relatability in this film. Certainly for me anyway, there's a huge amount of relatability in it. All the relatability that I felt kind of orbits that concept, that I know that this is the way I should go. I know that this is the way I want to go and have dreamed of going for many, many years. But maybe, you know, maybe it's not going to happen. Maybe it's too late now. Maybe it's not worth embarking on this redemptive arc because I can't achieve it. I think that's something that all the characters think of. You know, so clearly with
when
Li
Mu Bai, does Jen think of it?
Well, yeah, okay. So clearly Li Mu Bai and Xu Lin, we don't need to talk about that. They clearly have, they voice it. I think Jen feels that way regarding her family. you know, if I do this, that's it for them. If I go with Dark Cloud, or if I leave them and become, like, you know, a ninja on the run with Jade Fox, etc., that's it for my family. Mm-hmm. I can't go back, and they'll never take me back. And even when Li Mubai and Xu Yin are trying to talk sense to her and say, look, it's okay, you haven't gone too far yet, you haven't passed the point of no return, mm-hmm. they have to persuade her of that. Ayiko, you disagree?
No, it's not that I disagree. I have a hard time with her character, and I'm trying to figure out when there was this big... I mean, yes, I definitely agree that she's very concerned about her family, and maybe dishonoring them. But at the same time, she's not so concerned. Like, I mean, first of all, does her family know that she knows martial arts?
No.
Okay, so when her mom faints and she jumps on a horse... to chase
mom
after
didn't see all-
mom didn't see it, but clearly she right. felt comfortable enough to jump on a horse in front of all these people that are protecting her and her family and chase Lo. So what I'm saying is that, like, a lot of I have a very hard time with her redemptive arc, because I don't really feel like she has one. And I don't understand, like, yes, she cares about her family and the honor. But I feel like everything is motivated by the fact that, what Arthur had said before, she has no freedom. And so she's in this, I believe it's an arranged marriage. And mm-hmm. she doesn't want to go through with that. She wants to, you know, Jade Fox has taught her this, opened up her whole worldview in terms of who you could be. She meets Xu Lin and she's like, this is who I want to be. But everything is about, from the arc, as young people are, it's a very more selfish oriented, you know, state of mind, and how she's dealing with everything. Because even when they come to her and say, hey, could you do this or do that? And she's like, what is she called? She got all kinds of, like, smart comments towards them. And, like, you know, basically, F you, you're just mad because I have the sword. Like, even, like, in front of Li Mubai, she's still, like, she's never reverent or anything like that. She talks to him greasy. So I'm
Well, she's definitely petulant. But I think that beyond, does her petulance negate the fact that she has a redemptive arc?
And she's a badass, let's be honest.
She is a badass.
See, I am on the side with Ayiko on this. I believe that Jen's thinking about her family, the consequence of her leaving, all of that lives a little outside of the construct of I love my mother and father.
Right.
There's no scene where she comes back and she's embraced by her family. We missed you. That doesn't
true.
Happen.
That's true.
And even at the end of the film, she basically chooses to float away in the clouds than be attached to anybody.
No, I don't think that's true.
Oh, whoa.
I don't agree with that either.
Wait a minute. Not only does she choose to float, but listen, this is okay, this is my question then. Because I'm very confused about the end. She goes up to Wudang Mountain to meet Lo, right? This is after she's ruined everybody's fucking life. Then she goes up to meet Lo, and she tells him to make the choice of what wish for something. And he's like, I wish we could be back in the desert. And then she jumps off into the clouds. Okay, so number one, you're wishing, I guess she agrees that she wants to be back in the desert, but does this turn back the clock for everybody, or does it turn back the clock for her?
We're assuming that people who listen to this episode have seen the film. But let me. There's a parable. There's a parable, and just to paraphrase, because I can't remember it perfectly, but basically, Lo tells her a very beautiful story.
Absolutely gorgeous.
You know, again, there was that mini movie within the movie. So there is a space and time when they cut to a flashback. And me personally, I don't really love flashbacks in films. I typically tend to think after you see them once, it's like anytime I watch the movie again, I'm going to fast forward through this. But this one was like, it started off as a typical flashback and then became its own thing. And told it a complete love story. There was, as part of that love story, Lo does tell her, you know, how he chased the stars. And then he starts talking about this parable about a little boy whose parents, you know, were sick. And he wanted to, you know, he couldn't figure out how to make them well. And he leapt off a cliff or something and, you know, wished for their, you know, their return to health. And I know in the parable, the boy is never seen again. It's not like that he falls to his death and right. you know, that was the end. He's never seen again.
But his parents
and I assume
happy.
His parents got well.
Yeah.
I assume his wish came true. So let me just for a second, let me devil's advocate for Jen, though, because I do think I agree with you. She is petulant. She is very, very naive at times. And just she's a pain in the ass at times throughout a lot of the film. But I don't think that behavior negates the fact that she did have an arc. In my opinion, she did have a redemptive arc. And I agree with you guys in the sense that it doesn't revolve around, to me, I disagree with what Jay said a little bit. I don't think it necessarily revolves around her not wanting to dishonor her family. I think you guys are really downplaying the patriarchy. I think that in this time period, we are, you know, and it's reflected in Michelle Yeoh's character as well. She can't be what Mubai is because she's a woman, you know. Neither can Jen. And I think Jen is feeling those confined, or Jay Fox. Right, I think Jen is feeling the confinement in a way that is very, very visceral. For us as viewers, more so because it's almost like Jade Fox is bitter as hell about it. Michelle Yeoh seems to accept it, but Jen is like has the biggest struggle with it, because even when she goes off on her own for a little while with the Green Destiny, remember she's dressed as a boy, and everybody is addressing her as a, you know, the guys when they approach her at the bar or wherever at the restaurant, they think she's a boy. You know, they just call him. You know,
one second though, they call Jen Master. But the first time I saw it, that's exactly what I thought. But when I saw it last night, I caught that all the people who know Michelle Yeoh's character, they call her Master too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're obviously under no kind of ambiguity as to what gender she is.
Yeah, but in the restaurant scene, when the strangers approach her, they assume she's a boy.
But at the end, when they go back and they complain...
They say she.
...to them, they say she. So yeah. I don't know at what point that they figured out.
At that point when Mubai and Xu Lin show up, they may have told them that was a girl, you know. But I maintain, I think that, and I'll just to finish my point, I think that her redemptive arc is played out in that last scene. That's when we get like, okay, she remembers the parable. She she asks Lo to make the wish, because the boy in the parable, he didn't wish for anything for himself. He wished it was his parents, you know, he wanted to return to health. So when she jumps off of the cliff, she wants to give Lo what he wants. And what he wants is to be with her forever in the desert. And so it's a sacrifice. And that is her redeeming herself. She's been selfish the whole movie, you know, to an extent. Again, I don't want to downplay the patriarchy and wish, you know, her struggle with that. But at the same time, that last scene was her redeeming herself.
But why wouldn't she make the wish then and say, and still make the wish for herself? I wish that I hadn't been the jackass that I was, and therefore Li Mubai wouldn't be dead. Like, why didn't she wish for him and his life back?
I think she wanted to give Lo what he wanted.
I'm with Aiko on this, because Li Mubai gave his life for her, basically. You know, I mean, I know that he wanted to prosecute Jade Fox. I know he wanted to avenge his master's death. And, you know, I'm not taking anything away from that impulse, actually. But I think as the movie progressed, he put himself in the danger zone many, many times because he was looking out for Jen. If his sole purpose was, I'm going after Jade Fox, he wouldn't have let his guard down the way he did. You know, making sure Jen was okay, making sure she wasn't drugged, you know, mystically getting the poison out of her body, etc. He wouldn't have done any of that. He'd have been like, all right, Jay Fox around here somewhere. I'm going to be on my guard. I'm going to be on, you know, overwatch so that I can take her down. So he constantly gave her chances and constantly put himself and you know, Xu Lin and, you know, she did the same, but he put both of them at risk. So I'm with Aiko, you know, her petulance and her kind of her needs dominated throughout the whole movie, and they even perhaps continue to dominate at the end, even when she ostensibly sacrifices herself for Lo's dream. She knows what Lo is going to say. He's not going to say, oh yeah, here's my dream, by the way, it's got nothing to do with you. This, you know, the guy's entire purpose has been, I just want to be with you. She knows what he's going to ask.
And so that's what I find trouble with, is because she could have easily said, like, you know, I want, because she could have, like, first of all, she's up at Wudang Mountain. Like, where's her family? Like, if Arthur brings up a really good point, she isn't embraced when she comes back. I was like, do they even know she's missing? Like, but she's up at the mountain. Then it's just like, okay, she could have rode off into the sunset with this dude, and, or, you know, or made the choice of like you're going to jump off the bridge. Maybe there was a way. I know it's very poetic, and I think, and it's absolutely a beautiful ending. I have no problem with it, but I think I'm just always like, because of her choices, that dude is dead. And so he and Xu Lin will never get to be who they wanted to be because of the fact that like he came in there at the end to rescue her. He's throwing all these needles, and Jade Fox even said that was actually meant for her. So she's trying to kill her anyway. And then he's, you know, again, putting himself in harm's way. He ends up dying because of it. And it's great that she goes and she's like, yo, I know how to do this secret, like potion, the antidote. I'm going to go get it. I'm going to rush back. And all of these things are great and noble. But the reality is that she's in the situation because of just being, you know, I agree with Isaac 100% about the patriarchy. And I do agree that she is fighting against all of that and seeing what her future holds. At the same time, she is a rich, spoiled brat.
Yeah, but I think you guys are confusing the personality of a character and the narrative arc of a character. Well, you can have a character that's a spoiled brat that does all the things wrong, that, you know, causes the death of another character, so on and so forth. She still had an arc. And at the end, whether or not she succeeded in getting redemption or not, that jumping off the cliff was her trying to redeem herself.
That's fair.
In my opinion.
But I...
Yeah, I don't buy it.
I just wish she would have made the choice for them.
Yeah, exactly. Because she knew what Lo was going to ask. What he was going to ask was for her. You know, she knew it was almost like it's a safe bet. He's going to ask to be with me. That's what I want too. So all good.
But see, I think her jumping off the bridge was her like, you know what? I am out. I'm not going to be tied to any man's agenda. And that speaks directly to the patriarchy. I think her dressing up as a boy had more to do with knowing that she was, that people were looking for her, so she wanted to disguise herself, as opposed to I want to pass as a male in this patriarch. I think that was a thing, but I think it was initially, let me try to look like a boy as opposed to a young woman. And at some point, going back to Xu Lin and Mu Bai, at some point the two of them agreed to save this girl. We gotta do something.
Right.
So they get a whole escape route to get, you know, work out through Sir T and all that, you know, work their back channels to try to mitigate some kind of honor restoration to the family.
Right.
And get the girl, get Jin what she wants. And Jin just blows it all up.
Yep.
At one point, Xu Lin just is straight checking her.
Yep.
And I think it's right before they have that great sword fight.
Yeah, she's like, you're not a sister.
But I'm just saying that at the end of this, I just don't believe that at any point Jin had any feeling of redeeming. I don't believe that she felt that she did anything wrong beyond the obvious fact that Mu Bai got caught in the crossfire and actually jumped in front of the dart
to save
Jin.
Y'all are harsh as fuck.
You know, Isaac, she doesn't sacrifice anything.
Never.
She, you know, even in her final act, it's something that would lead her to happiness. She doesn't sacrifice anything.
Yep.
Yeah. I think Jin's the obstacle. I think Jin's the obstacle that prevents Mu Bai and anybody else from redeeming themselves. Even Dark Cloud, who came back to find Jin so that he could prove to her father that he was worthy. And Jin's like, none of that. I'm not having any of that.
Well, I don't think she prohibits Xu Lin or Li Mu Bai from redeeming themselves. I don't think she does that. I mean, I think, of course, her act physically stops them from being together. But, you know, they act with honor throughout the whole movie. They go after Jin, not just for her, but for her family as well, right? You know, they tell her father, don't worry, we got this.
Right, but they choose to do that.
They choose, sure, but they're also under a kind of, you know, under a code, under agreement that this is what people in our position must do for people in your position.
You think so? I thought it was a little more personal. I thought it was a little more personal than that with Xu Lin, because she kind of tells Mu Bai, okay, well, look, let me talk to the girl first. Let me just talk to her, because she understands certain things about the patriarchal society that they're living in and has some knowledge of this balance between the honor toward the family and the personal desire.
Let me ask you guys something. During that final solo fight between Jen and Xu Lin, Xu Lin's kind of going relatively easy on her. Jen is really struggling despite having the Green Destiny with all her badass level of kung fu. She's having a hard time. Xu Lin has multiple opportunities, including one right at the end where she basically stops short of a killer blow to Jen's neck and is like, look, you need to back down now, etc. And then Jen sucker punches, basically. She sucker punches Xu Lin and draws blood. Xu Lin, of course, is furious with Jen. Li Mu Bai witnesses it. He's furious too. At that point, let me ask you guys, why didn't they cut loose of Jen and say, right, that's it. You don't deserve all the care that we've been giving you. You don't deserve all the chances that we've given you. Now you're going down. Li Mu Bai kind of starts that, but then he backs down again. Why is that?
You're saying, why didn't Mu Bai and Xu Lin just give up on Jen?
Jahan, I was going to say, I actually felt during that fight that Xu Lin was giving. I don't think she was, I think her becoming furious, like, fueled her to another level. But I do think that Jen was holding her own with her the entire time. And I think that that was showing how good Jen actually was. Like, yes, Xu Lin is a master, but with the Green Destiny, now I don't know if she didn't have the sword, maybe it wouldn't have been the same case.
I think that's the key.
Because a couple of times Xu Lin looked like, God damn, that damn sword, let me get something bigger.
Because she kept having to you know, find all that, these other things to combat the sword. But Jin still, you know, if she didn't have the sword, she would have got her ass beat. But like, you know, but with having the sword, Xu Lin was holding her own, but it's just, I do think that Jen, I think in the scene they were showing how much, I don't want to quite say peer, but just how much on the level she was, that, you know, how good she was.
The thing that I disagree with you, Ayiko, is that they repeatedly show Jen as out of breath, as sweating.
True.
I definitely think it's closer to what Arthur said, that basically the Green Destiny was, or both of you guys were saying, the Green Destiny was the difference.
Yeah, and she's never fought that long either, I don't think. Yeah, you're right.
She said it in the scene, guys. She said it in the scene. Xu Lin said, you're nothing without the Green Destiny.
Right.
That whole scene was played out. It was a combination of a lot of things that happened in the film. It was the seriousness. You know, she was angry because she was like, you're no longer my sister.
Right.
It was the anger. Then it was also some comedy involved, which the film had comedy in it, you know, so there's elements of comedy when you kept seeing Xu Lin go back and get different weapons, because no matter what weapon she had, even when she found that one pole that seemed to have some effect against the Green Destiny sword, the Green Destiny cut through everything. And so that's when it was like, yeah, Jen is bad. Jen is dope. I'm not taking anything away from her. Right. But Xu Lin is the master. And it became clear the longer the fight went on, Xu Lin was giving her all. But the Green Destiny, you can't, you know, go against it because it cuts through everything in the hand of someone as competent as Jen was. Now, Xu Lin did win the fight because
she did.
You know, she got to the point she could have cut her throat if she wanted to.
She did.
She won the fight and she spared her life. Now, to answer Jay's question, though, what was the scene, Jay, right after this one? What was the scene? What happened next in the story? I can't remember. They went to,
that's when they go to the top of the trees, to the treetops.
Okay, all right. So, yeah. So, I think that...
Because Li Mu Bai, he witnesses her drawing blood and he chases her out, basically.
So, I think to answer your question, why didn't they give up on her? I wonder, and it would take someone from that culture to explain it to us, really, someone knowledgeable of that. I think it may be a cultural thing. I think sometimes when we're talking about some of these films, we forget how we would react towards something. It's not necessarily how someone else of a different culture would react. I think that's one part of it. Then also, this film is kind of played as a parable. You know, this film is kind of like explained to us with the magic realism, with the non-specificity of what year it is. It's kind of like told to us as a parable. And in parables, nobody's just like, all right, I'm done with you. That's the end of the story. There's always some type of, then they went into the trees, you know what I'm saying? And it's like, you get a magical, beautiful scene like that where they're like balancing on bamboo things and he's still trying to reach out to her and get her to be his disciple and this, that, and the third. So that made sense to me. But I still, I guess, again, my major, you know, and we can move on after this. I think we spent too much time on just debating whether or not Jen has a redemptive arc. But my main thing, I think, with my main point to you guys is that I agree with you in that she's not a likable character at all. She made many mistakes. She was very selfish. I think I have more sympathy for what confined her and what she was going against. Yeah. I think I have more sympathy for that than you guys have displayed during this episode. But I do think that whether or not I like her or whether or not I think she made the right choices doesn't negate the fact that she sought something or she tried to do something. Maybe mm-hmm. she didn't do it the right way. Jahan mentioned sacrifice before. I don't always think redemption necessitates sacrifice. I don't think that. I think you can seek redemption without always having sacrifice. So if she didn't sacrifice something, maybe that was her mistake. But I also don't think that kind of like, you know, again, negates the fact that she sought in the end to correct some of her wrongs in the wake of Mubei's death. And I also just lastly, I don't think he died for her, so to speak. He wanted to kill Jade Dragon. He went up against Jade Dragon.
Jade Fox.
He got stuck with that poison thing. Jade Fox, I'm sorry. He got stuck with the poison needle. I can't say he died for her. You know, if he would have went up against Jade Fox, you know, in a just them two in a field or something, he could have died then as well. I'm not sure if he died for Jen so much as he died, you know, fulfilling that part of his destiny, which again I think was a somewhat of a distraction from his true destiny, which he realized in his last moments of life.
I know I identified, or at least I asserted, that Jen in and of herself was an obstacle or at least an opposing force between these characters, specifically Mubei and Shui Lin and Redemption. Would you agree with that, anyone? That Jen is the obstacle?
I agree 100%.
Well, one thing, just one note very quickly, when Mubei says to her, you know, at one point, because he offers, you know, to teach her at least three times during the film, maybe more. But at one point he does say, when she says, you know, why do you want to teach me? He says, I always wanted a disciple. Mm. So this is not a completely selfless act. You know, it's not like, and again, this is why I keep coming back to the fact, I think he was really distracting himself. You know, that's why I disagree with you guys. I think he was distracting himself from his true path.
Yeah.
And I always wanted a disciple, you know, it's the Wudan and I wanted the manual and, you know, all these things and these, you know, these protocols and everything. And I feel like he's distracting himself. So I think for Mubei individual, I think his obstacle was himself, you know, and I'm gonna be real, you know, all jokes aside, his man code was his obstacle. You know, when we had the conversation before and Jay asserted that, you know, you can't let the man code get in the way of your happiness. In this movie, he was absolutely allowing man code, honor code, whatever you want to call it, get in the way of his own happiness. And that was his obstacle. His allegiance to tradition, to honor, to all these things, to his own legend. You know, he's a legend. You know, he was famous. So to his own thing, to the Green Destiny, all these things, him giving up the Green Destiny at the beginning of the film and wanting to retire and still not, you know, reaching out his hand to her and saying, you know, I love you, you know, can we do this? Yeah. He does it later on in the film, but at the beginning of the film.
Aiko brought this up earlier. He was willing to let that go pretty early because when he got to Peking and was sitting with the man code, when he was sitting at the table, when he arrived at Peking, when he arrived at Surtees place and he was having a conversation with Shu Lin, who started apologizing for losing the Green Destiny, but I'll get it back. Dude was like, oh no, I just found out about the Green Destiny when I got here. She's like, why are you here? He was like, well, we were talking back at your spot.
Right.
Yeah, but
right.
there's 20 years.
I'll give you that point, but that's not at the beginning of the film.
I'm saying that's not at the end when he professes his love. The part that you're alluding to, Arthur,
is the part that I just mentioned. You know, that's the part I mentioned. That's why I was saying later on in the film, not at the very end, but later on in the film.
But at the moment that he
gives up the Green Destiny at the beginning of the film, he doesn't do it. And maybe to your point, maybe he was, you know, trying to initiate that conversation, but he was a little lax with it, and then the moment passed.
But that's the obstacle I see for him.
Who knows how long he and Shu Lin have had these feelings for each other. Conceivably, they've been denying their feelings for many, many, many years. So just because Li Mubai is making an effort now at this point, it doesn't necessarily negate all the years that have gone past.
No, I mm-hmm. agree with that. So what do you guys think? Okay, so I think we're kind of on the same page as far as his obstacle. What about, what is Xu Lin's obstacle?
Well, I guess being honorable, but not really telling him, you know, your man code, it's been going on for a while, and I don't necessarily know that it's realistic.
Is that, but her, I feel the honor part, but there seems to be something, and Michelle Yeoh, I got to give her, I really liked her.
Dude, she's incredible.
You know, I think that she gave a very understated, mm-hmm. subtle performance that the whole movie was understated in many ways, but she, to Arthur's point earlier on the episode, mentioned she's kind of the center
piece
of this
film.
To me.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It's her
right.
movie.
Yeah.
And she, you know, and it, arguably Jen is in more, has more screen time. You know, Jen has definitely more screen time than Michelle Yeoh's character, but Xu Lin is the centerpiece. So there seems to be something else there, though. It's like, yeah, I'm, you know, I'm with the honor thing too. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. You know, I was engaged to your best friend. We can't do this. It would dishonor his memory. But there's something else there. You know, there's something that it's hard to put your finger on, but there's something else there that's in her way. And it's almost, and I'm going to be honest with you guys, what I think it may be, her love for him, and this is crazy, but her love for him, for Mubai, is so great that it's almost as if she doesn't want to see him dishonor himself. Like, in other words, I don't want to be the reason that you F up your honor, or that you go against your own code.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I don't want to be the reason for that. Yeah. And that's kind of the vibe I got from her, which as the viewer only made me like her more. Cause if I was him, I'd be like, I'd throw it out the window. I'd be like, yeah, we're going to do this just because mm-hmm. that's how much she loves him, you know? And that's a beautiful thing.
Let me ask a question. Do you feel that Xu Lin wanted to work out the issue with Jen? She knew early that it was Jen who stole the sword. She knew that it was Jen that she herself fought in the courtyard once the sword was first taken. That, hey, if I can handle this, work this out with this young girl, then you and I, Mubai, we can move forward.
I don't think that was a precursor. No. Right? I don't think any of this is part of a list necessarily. I think it's just circumstantial. I think that, you know, Xu Lin had her priority. Her priority was to, the way I saw it, her priority was to be with Li Mubai, to realize mm-hmm. this kind of unspoken secret love that they had been running from, and to stop wasting time. Jen was in the mix, and, you know, Xu Lin was attending to that. But I had no feeling during the movie that her priority was not Li Mubai.
I agree with you that Mubai was Xu Lin's priority. And to get to that priority, she felt that she had to manage these situations that kept coming up. Here's this girl, she stole your sword, then this boyfriend comes out of nowhere.
I don't think they've got anything to do with it. I think that she's a master, you know, she's head of the security force, like you said, the local security force for the governor, etc. Crimes have been committed against the governor and his family. And she's fulfilling her duty, you know, her job description and her honor in attending to those things. I don't think that she feels that these are things that she needs to tick off a list in order to get to Li Mubai. These are not steps that she needs to go through. I don't get that feeling at all. I think she's just doing what she, you know, what her job is during that time. I think that, as Isaac was saying at the start, Li Mubai, however, I don't think he actually ever works out what his priority is. I think Isaac used the phrase easily distracted.
He is. He's also distracted by Jen, and they allude to it twice in the film where Xu Lin says, oh, I knew she would intrigue you. And there's kind of some undertone there. And then at the end when she's drugged up and she's like, yeah, you like me, you know, because, you know, you're attracted to me.
I didn't get that at all.
So there's also a little bit.
I didn't necessarily get that.
There's a little, but they do it twice, and they even in the bamboo trees when they're showing like him, like he's clearly studying her, and I'm not saying he's studying her because he wants to get with her, but at the same time, look how he looks away from her when, you know, she's drugged up and she's like rubbing on herself and is just like, yeah, like this is part of what it's about. Xu Lin says to him, "I knew she would intrigue you." Yeah. No, I'm not saying that that's the full thing. I think he is a man of honor in general, but he's still a man. And this is a very beautiful young girl who's got wicked talent. And so at the same time, Xu Lin even says to him, I knew she would intrigue you. And there is a little something there when she says it.
Yeah, I think what was there, though, in my opinion, when she says that, you know, I knew she would intrigue you. What was there was that two things. One, because he is a Wudan, you know, master.
It's a skill
and
level.
She's basically like, I knew that her skill level would intrigue you. And also, I think Xu Lin is aware on some level, maybe subconsciously, that he is seeking distractions from her, you know, and things to do other than to, you know, dwell on the fact that they have this forbidden love. So I think that she, you know, yeah, she would intrigue you in the sense of, yeah, you may want to train her. You know, here's a disciple for you. Mm. When Jin later on, alludes to the fact that, you know, she's attractive and, oh, your interest in me is not just, that's her being petulant. I think it has nothing to do with him. And I think he looks away because he's just like, ugh, like, you know, I didn't feel that way towards you. I'm like, I'm not appropriate. You know, that's not what I'm about. She does it as a way to almost, you know, throw shade on him. And it's like, and he's like, little girl, that's not what this is about. What I said to you, I'm a man of honor. What I said to you is what I meant. Now you taking it some other way and going to somewhere, and he looks away like, here, you know, that's not what this is about. So that's what I got from it.
I mean, I agree with that, but I also think that there is a slight little something underneath there. And I'm not saying that he is necessarily saying, or they're alluding to in the film, that this is what his motivation is, because he is a man of honor and he is, you know, interested in having a disciple. But I do think that it's very interesting that, like, you know, I just felt like there were a couple of things here and there. They're just like little sprinkles of, like, you know, just adding some further complication or obstacle without it being having to be something that's super obvious and isn't anything like, you know, it's just more human shit than it would be like, actually, like, this is what this character would do, because that's not who he is.
That's an interesting point, because, I mean, Jade Fox's whole thing was apparently she was intriguing to Mubai's master. We don't really know her full backstory.
I wish
but we do
would.
Know that.
Yeah, she could never be like, you know, she could learn all this other stuff, but like she could never be elevated to anything more than sleeping with him.
Completely agreed. And that's why I kind of struggle a little bit with this point, because he wants to give Jen everything that was denied of Jade Fox.
Hmm.
If there's one obstacle for Li Mubai, it's his ego stroke honor. And my question is, are those things totally inseparable or can one corrupt the other?
Yeah, I think absolutely one can corrupt the other. Yeah. Yeah. I think they can be separate, but one can corrupt the other. And I think ego slash honor or fear slash honor, your fear can corrupt your honor, or your honor, your fear can use your honor as a shield. Yeah. And I think back to Xu Lin for a second, her obstacle to me was that for a good part of the film, she was guilty of some of the same things that Mubai was guilty of, you know, using honor, using duty as a way to, you know, shield herself from her fear or her pain, you know, or her broken heart. And it really, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm remembering this correctly, but it really wasn't until when she found out about Lo, you know, because for the most part of the film, she was trying to convince Jin to give up the sword and to do, you know, what she's supposed to do to honor her family.
Right.
She wasn't trying to convince her, you know, take the sword or, you know, follow, go to Wudan, you know, leave your family behind, follow your own path. She wasn't doing that, you know, and I think that maybe she was, you know, looking at Jin and saying, you know, I went through this, you know, and it didn't work out for me. It's not going to work out for you either. Just go with your family, do what you're going to do, give up this crazy dream. But correct me if I'm wrong, when she learned about Lo, then she was like, when she learned about the love that this girl had lost out on.
Yeah.
Then she was like, yeah, you need to go to Wudan. We sent Lo to Wudan. You know, we've set this up for you.
Yeah.
Go there, be with him.
Yeah.
You know, that's when she, and so again, to me, that's when it was like, yeah, she saw a little bit of herself in this, you know, this selfish, petulant child. but she saw a little bit of herself in there, and was when she learned that she had given up on a love. And not in the same way, but in a similar way as she had given up on her love for Mubai. I think, you know, she came around and said, I'm going to help this girl. You know, I'm going to help her in a different way than I've helped her before.
Which goes back to your original point of just being women in that time period and not being able to fulfill your own destiny, but having to have everyone make choices for you. So you're absolutely right. Yeah.
And that's part of the bravery of this film, is that they presented these three women And usually, especially in American films, they may present, if they're trying to make a didactic point, they may say, you know what, here are three characters that are absolutely pure. You can't, you know, you, there's nothing controversial about these characters. These are your heroes, and we're going to use them to show why patriarchy is wrong. In this film, they gave us three very complex. Only one of them is really a good guy, you know, so to speak. The other two are definitely, you know, corrupted to some degree. One of them completely corrupted. But we have, just speaking for myself, I have sympathy for all of them. I have empathy for all of them in the sense that even the Jade Fox, look at what she went through. You know what I'm saying? Look at what happened to her. Look at what she was denied. And it, you know, you could argue, I don't know if she was always crazy, but that, if she wasn't, that made her crazy, exactly. You know, by the end.
Well, denied by friend and foe.
Yep.
Right. So, and to your point, Jay, you know, when you see Chow Yun-Fat's character basically try to do everything she did, at no point is he like, yeah, you know, that's messed up that Jade Fox couldn't do this, you know, because she should have been able to. Nah, he's just like, you will be my disciple. I've always wanted a disciple, you know, and it's like he can do that because he's a man, you know, whereas it was denied to these women. So I give it up to Ang Lee. And, you know, I think it's a cultural thing for them to be able to present these three very complicated, complex characters. But they're still they bear the weight of showing us what the danger, what the implications of patriarchy is within this construct.
And he did it again in Brokeback Mountain. So Ang Lee is very good at, like, you know, kind of showing you the historical, like, this is where people are and this is what they're trying to fight against. But yeah, his film is really beautiful for that.
So what about, so we talked about Mubai, we talked about Shaolin. I mean, we've talked Jen to death. You guys have, like, you know, kicked her, thrown her off the cliff.
She threw herself. But...
and then jumped up on top of her.
All right, so did any of these characters find redemption?
Let me answer that.
I'm almost afraid to hear what Jay is about to say.
Xu Yin, I'm going to give her a pass on this one. It takes two to tango. I think she had shown Li Mubai that she was open. She was just caught out at a bad time. Li Mubai, I would say he did find redemption right at the end. Because right at the end, you know, he could conserve his breath for just a little bit more. He could conserve his energy with his kind of super meditation for just a little bit longer. And he decides, no, you know what? I might not make it. I do not want to make it without telling this woman in the clearest of terms. I am in love with you. I have loved you for so many years. And it's my fault. I have wasted all this time. It's on me. I give him that. Jen, I don't think so. I think giving Lo his one wish, assuming the parable was true, and if she jumped from the mountain, his wish would come true. She gave him a wish that she knew would lead her to her happiness. You know, she didn't jump thinking, you know what, forget Lo. I'm going to jump and I'm going to wish that Li Mubai is resurrected and that he and Xu Yin live together happily and finally can realize their love forever. She didn't do that. So I would say no for her.
Yep.
Arturius, Aiko.
I would agree with that.
I agree with Jahan.
So I think mine, I'm a little bit different in the sense that, like I said at the beginning of the episode, although I see redemption reflected in each of these characters, we've talked about it a lot, I really see this film as just one major redemptive theme, and then it gets reflected in these characters. And I think that redemption, I said before, I think it's this movie is love redemption. Like this is, will love get redeemed? And I think that, yes, it does. Now, if I was going to break it down individually with those, the three leads, yes, I think it happens with Xu Lin and definitely with Mubai in that last scene when they realize he vocalizes it, but she realizes it too. We both wasted, you know, all this time. Why? You know, we both wasted it. So I think the realization in this sense is a redemption to some degree. You know, it'd have been great had they realized it, you know, a year ago. That would have been, fantastic. But the realization in this scene is the redemption. And I maintain, I think Jen achieved it as well. I think Jen's wish, you know, when she says to Lo, you know, what do you wish for? And she knows what he's going to say. I think what she's saying is that, or what she, in her mind, is that she realizes, has she stayed in that desert? I don't think it's about going to the desert at that moment. I think it's more about them never leaving that desert. Had they never left that desert and that whole middle part of the movie just became their lives, none of these other things would have happened. You know, she would have followed her own path. She would have been happy. the whole Green Destiny thing wouldn't have happened, the death of Mubai, none of that stuff would have happened. And I think the night before she jumps off the cliff, when she's there making love and she's crying, and you can see it in her eyes, you know, it's almost, that's the real, that's that moment for me is when she realizes everything, you know. And then the next morning she, you know, says to Lo, you know, what would be your wish, knowing what he's going to say. I think it's that she feels like let's return to the desert and have never left that desert. And maybe none of these things would have ever happened. And of course, because it's a parable, because it's a poem, it's, you know, it ends in a way that doesn't give us any definitive answers and doesn't really need to. That's not the whole point. But I think that for her in that moment, she was seeking her redemption. So overall, I think that did love find redemption in this movie? And I would say yes.
Nice.
Who knew that Isaac was such a softie?
As eloquently as Isaac put that, I just can't buy into it. I just feel that Jen's final act of jumping off the bridge at Wudan Mountain was her realizing that everyone, from her viewpoint, everyone wanted something from her, something of her. And she was refusing to be tied to anyone else's agenda because she wanted to be free. And that was the only way that she was able to do it. Now, as poetic as the film is, especially the ending, we don't know if she succumbs to gravity. And we're kind of left with what happened, and
she disappeared, Arthur, just like the little boy in the parable. She was never seen again, and maybe neither was Lo.
Which leads us into our segment for this episode, Rewrite. A bit of a what-if scenario where we're going to imagine the trajectory of the major theme for the characters. Now, Aiko's been talking about this desert scene, and we have not talked about the desert scene. It was done very well.
Absolutely.
The movie within the movie.
Yep.
I share the sentiment with Isaac where it's like, oh yeah, right, we're at the desert. But then it's like, man, I just cannot turn away from this. And it's the only time that in a film that I've seen where the flashback is handled in detail. A lot of times they just kind of get into the flashback and get out of it. But here we're giving some real detail. And this is the most that we find out about Jen. So, Aiko, what's up with you in the desert scene?
My only beef.
Do you want to rewrite this? Do you want to rewrite the, is this like you're picking this segment to rewrite, or is this like going to lead to a rewrite of the theme?
I would pick this segment to rewrite, not the way that it's shot, I love that the way they did the entire thing. My only beef with this is that you have this kind of stereotypical role where the fighting leads to sexual tension, and therefore this is how they fall in love, and boom.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't make sense. Like, just yeah. because they're fighting over and over again. And then, like, what I think is one of the best scenes, and I don't really see this done a lot, but, like, I love that Lo's honor and him showing mm-hmm. who he is as a man is he's just like, you can take a bath. You don't have to. First of all, he says, if I would have done something, I would have already done it. You can take mm-hmm. a bath. I'm going to keep singing so that you know where I am at all times so that you can feel safe, which is fucking mm-hmm. incredible to see a man do that. You know what I mean? Or whatever. And shows mm-hmm. like, okay, yeah, he's this warrior.
You can feel safe in your captivity.
Well, sure.
Right.
But he kind of, yeah. But she kind of went with him out there. You know what I mean? Or whatever. But, like, you know, whatever the case is, yeah, safe in your captivity. But one of the things that is just problematic is, like, the whole, like, okay, we're going to fight. And during this fight, where I'm, you know, then all of a sudden it becomes sex. And that's the thing that I'm just like, really? Like, really? Like, it could just be like, it could have just been held on its own of that the fact that, like, she came to respect him. You see her face, like, soften towards him when he's like, I'm gonna sing and whatever. Like, you see the point, but I'm just like, I understand films and how people fall in love. But to me, Li Mubai and Xu Lin, they talk about how long they'd been around one another and how that became a different love. Here, this is a very short span of time for them to, and maybe because they're young, I don't know, whatever, but like a short span of time to fall in love, and then suddenly we're gonna have sex because we're tussling.
Let's talk about that scene in detail since we're rewriting it. Let's, because it is that scene, you know, the entire scene lasts a few minutes, but that moment of them tussling and then it, you know, going, it is a huge trope, especially in older films.
Exactly.
It happened in at least 4 or 5 James Bond movies, you know, Goldfinger most famously, where it was, you know, it was borderline rape, you know, and that's, I've seen it in other films as well, where, you know, the either the sex or the smack across the face or you know, oh, you're really smacking me because you want me to make love to you, you know, and it's a trope. But let's talk about that scene in detail, because it begins, I think, Aiko, correct me if I'm wrong, but it begins when he's in front of her and she picks up the sharp, I don't know if it's a dagger, I don't know what it is, something sharp. And she holds it, expecting him to like take it from her. And he just looks at her. And in that moment, I was okay, because I thought, okay, even though I felt, you know, I was scared for him because I thought, you know, he's about to get killed. I like that, because it was another moment of him saying, you're safe here.
Right.
You know, it's like, I'm not going to hurt you. You know, so he waited for a second. He just stood there in front of her, basically putting his life in danger to show her that she's safe. And of course, what does she do? She stabs him.
Yeah. Now, was this before or after she hits him over the head with a rock?
This was after.
This was after.
That was after.
Because she had ran away and then he brought her back again. Okay. So she stabs him, and then it becomes the whole stereotypical tussle thing.
Yeah.
So what would you, let me ask you, in your rewrite, Aiko, would you have kept the stab in there? And if so, why?
I would have kept the stab in there, because I just thought it was hilarious. Because she stabbed him, but she kind of, it wasn't like a, I'm going to puncture your lung and really let you have it. It was kind of like,
she was
testing. Yeah, she's like, you know, and there's a little stab.
She did draw blood, though.
She did draw blood.
It was a playful stabbing.
There was blood, noticeable exactly. blood through the armor. But Aiko, let me ask you, though, her testing him, that was, again, though, her almost in disbelief that, are you really this honorable? Are you really that concerned about me? You know, and that, are you willing to make sure that I feel this safe? You know, you did the singing thing. That was cute. That was a big moment.
That was amazing.
You're just going to sit here defenseless, you know, while I got this dagger in. And then she kind of like pokes him to test him. So you would have kept that in.
I just thought it was funny. Like, it just seemed like, because again, it's that petulance a little bit or whatever, but it's like, it was consistent with her character. So mm-hmm. I appreciated that. But then when it just goes into the fight, I'm just like, I just feel like that.
So what do you do after that, after the stabbing, instead of the fight?
If I were him, I would have told her, laid it all out. Could have been like,
no, you're the writer.
Yeah,
now,
if I were him, I would have laid it all out. I've done this, and this to show da da da, and this is how you're whatever. I need you, like, in mm-hmm. the same, you know, just to have an honest mm-hmm. conversation, versus like the continuing, like, let's keep fighting, and have her finally just say, you're right, like, I am into you. I am da da da. I am curious or whatever, and then go from there, as opposed to stereotypical, like, you know, because at some point, his hand is under, you know, in her pants. And I'm just like, well, when did that happen? Like, you know what I mean? Or whatever. So
right,
I don't know. Like,
exactly.
did he just finally give up on being honorable and here we go? Or, you know, because she looks down like, oh, shit, or whatever. And she's clearly into it. But like, I just feel like I like when there's a little more like agency and people actually do what they want to do, as opposed to just like, oh, I'm going to pretend that I don't want to do this because it hits this fantasy. It's like, no, she's a sexual being. She's clearly attracted to this dude. Let, you know, she's already going against the patriarchy by doing what she's doing anyway. So let her own that, as opposed to like, just like, it kind of falls into this like weird little, you know, thing. And then it's like, oh, okay, then they can go for it. Like, she's been in. Yeah.
This movie was original. Again, it played out like a parable in so many ways, but it was original in other ways. And I think that this scene was probably the most unoriginal scene in the entire film.
Agreed.
You know, it was the one scene I was like, I had the same reaction. I was like, for real?
Yeah, like, just like, let her,
you know, you're going to do it.
Do what she want to do. But the scene within the scene, because the desert scene itself, I do think is a really, it's one of the few films that I'm just like, this flashback does not annoy me at all. Like, it's really cool.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
It's not just the fighting to me. I have a real problem with films that present this kind of adversarial relationship, you know, aggressively adversarial, you know, predatorially, I should say, predatorially adversarial relationship between men and women. And then it resolves into this kind of Stockholm syndrome sort of situation where the hostage falls in love with their captor. And it's not just the fight to me that mm-hmm. kind of rubs me the wrong way here. Let's not forget, mm-hmm. she was bound. You know, she was bound by the hands, she was bound by the ankles. He had her not just in captivity away from her family, you know, without an ability to escape, you know, weak, etc. He had her tied up. For me, the whole...
But didn't he tie mm-hmm. her up after she popped him in the head?
Yeah, sure. But that's like, you know, mm-hmm. she popped him in the head because he kidnapped her. You know,
so he didn't kidnap her.
She followed him.
Yeah. She followed him. Sure.
He didn't kidnap her
because he's a.
He had her comb. He had her comb.
But he's a raiding marauder.
Bandit,
right? Yeah, he's a bandit. He's a marauder. he's attacking her way of life, etc. You know, she's got a hell of a backbone. She goes after him, etc. What I would have much preferred is whoever wrote this film proved themselves so adept at writing beautiful dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It would have been so easy for them to establish an interest on her part via dialogue, a kind mm-hmm. of verbal sparring. You know, maybe they're both on mm-hmm. their horses, looking at each other, talking to each other, etc., challenging each other. It would have been so easy for them to establish mm-hmm. something like that without it having to be this kind of, I'm a man, I'm overpowering you, but then you're going to actually see I'm actually not a bad guy, I'm a sweet guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that.
That's very true.
I agree with that. And I think there's a lot of examples of that. One that, since I just made a James Bond reference, I'm going to make another one. One that jumps in my head is a Casino Royale with the verbal sparring between Daniel Craig's character and Eva Green's mm-hmm. character, you know, and that train scene, which was great writing. You know, they clearly are like, you know, just they're sparring with each other.
It's
and
sexy.
It's not a man woman thing. It's just it has a sexual undertone to it. Love Jones, you know, to go completely on another another side of it mm-hmm. between Lorenz Tate and Nia Long, you know, their verbal sparring. So there's a lot of examples of that. And there's a bunch of 40s and movies in the 40s and 30s where they did a lot of great verbal sparring like that. So, yeah, I agree with Jay.
Mm-hmm.
At least so that the woman doesn't capitulate. You know, there's no sort of feeling that she's overpowered, etc. Like another movie that you can bring up is Out of Sight, the Steven Soderbergh movie with George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, he mm-hmm. does kidnap her when she tries to stop him busting out of jail. She does kidnap her, throws her in the back of a trunk, jumps in with her. They're talking. They have their little moment.
Mm-hmm.
But then she says, you're not going to get away with this. But he's being remotely respectful in that very disrespectful situation. He gets out of the trunk and she immediately starts shooting. So he and Ving Rhames run off. They all separate. But Clooney and Lopez, they have this, they have their moments throughout the whole film, you know, where they see or speak to each other on the phone, outside a car, in a hotel lobby. And it's very, very mm-hmm. separate and gradual. And ultimately, they finally meet in a hotel and then in a heist after
that. It's a great scene.
Yeah, it is.
It's all very sort of step by step, very, very gradual. It doesn't all happen at once. So I just felt that like there could have been more subtlety here for that. For all the subtlety, and Isaac, you said it best, for all the originality in the film, I felt that this segment, this kind of idea here, it kind of let it down a little bit.
Yeah, he nailed it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Agree 1,000%. One quick devil's advocate for Lo, though. I think one of the reasons he had her bound was he knew that if she escaped, she was going to die out in that desert, you know, which she almost did. And so that's,
but
I think,
then
one
should
of
have
the
had
reasons
her
he had her bound.
They should have had him articulate that.
Exactly. Like,
well, it was subtle, John.
Yes, fool.
I mean, that was a great rewrite because, I mean, that was the one part of the film where I was like, ugh, that was expected and whack and boring and not good. You know?
Can we
so,
also address man code quickly?
Please.
I just want to say that I agree with man code and girl code and totally appreciate, but for the amount of time, one, and two, the friend and fiance that passed away, if we're just talking about it in very a typical stance, I don't think that anybody who is passed away, whose spirit's going to be like, yo, I don't want the two people that I love the most to not get together because I'm dead In fact, you would be 100%. Like, you give them their blessing. You don't care about stuff 100%. Like that. Like, you can be like, yo, I want these people to be happy.
100%.
Like, I'm sitting here chilling. I wouldn't.
as long as your intentions are pure, that should be the only code that you adhere to.
Like, they didn't just want to get together 2 weeks later or something, but if they had known each other for years and they developed, like, you know, like, it's almost the same thing. Like, if I had dated somebody, like, back in the day, whatever, and then had nothing to do with them, and it wasn't like a really serious relationship or whatever, and one of my friends just happens, like, depending on the circumstance, if I was like, if this is like a real opportunity and you guys really love each other and it's not just because you're sexually curious or whatever, then I would probably give my blessing and to say, you know, maybe you should explore that, but these are the boundaries that have to be around it in order for people to feel comfortable. But it has to be like somebody I wasn't in touch with for a really long, like, it has to be some
you got
yeah, I do, because it can't just be like it's somebody.
You guys are hardcore. I have zero stipulations,
you know, but like in terms of them, I'm like, they had really been around each other and grown to love one another.
But see, I think though with them, it was almost played to the point with her, Shulin's love for Ming, I forgot his name, for the friend, paled in comparison to her love for mm-hmm. Mubai. Like, Mubai was like her real soulmate.
Exactly. You know,
and
that's where I think that was the other part of this. Now, for me, Jay, I give you permission, Jay. I have to be gone. I'm going to put the stipulations. I got to be gone for a long time. You always have to be second to me. And I'll see you in hell. Know this.
This has been Snobs on Film. I am Arthur. I'm joined with Aiko, Jahan, and Isaac. This has been our redemptive analysis on Ang Lee's 2000 film, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. The cult film to end all cult films is the topic of discussion on the next episode of Snobs on Film, Redemption. We're diving deep into the nuances and complexities of Donnie Darko, and we're inviting you to come along for the ride. See you in 2 weeks. Subscribe or follow in Apple Podcasts. You can follow us on Spotify. We can be found online at snobsonfilm.com, and our Twitter handle is snobsonfilm. See you next show. So I know we're done. I know we're wrapped, but special shout out to Bo.
Yes, my man, Bo. He made it through the whole movie too.
Oh, the little
Bo. You thought he was going to get killed early, didn't you? Because he looked like
Bo. Yeah.